Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. The topic this week is The Sims, improv, and video game parties. Human interaction is challenging even under the best of circumstances, and for years, this week's guest was resigned to just always having difficulty understanding other people. Comedian Christopher Smith Bryant picked up techniques for socializing from interactive entertainment like video games, and later from improv classes. His adult life has been a series of unexpected discoveries, from the realization that he actually shouldn't be a minister, to a recent diagnosis that's helped him understand how to navigate a world that he'd always found difficult to make sense of. We'll have that conversation in a moment. First, I want to let you know about a new project I've just announced. You've probably heard me talk about my show Queens of Adventure, a comedy storytelling podcast where drag queens play Dungeons and Dragons. Well, for the first time ever, we're taking our cast on the road. We're bringing them to Chicago to record a dozen hours of new adventures with local drag artists and D&D shows in the Midwest. There's a Kickstarter underway to make the trip possible, and if you pledge now, you can get some gorgeous nerdy gay enamel pins, bonus episodes, and even guest on an episode of the show. Head over to queensofadventure.com and click the banner at the top for all the details on our ongoing Kickstarter. The campaign ends on September 14th. Now, here's Chris. Well, this week I'm speaking with Christopher Smith Bryant, a comedian in Los Angeles and one of the leaders of the LA Gaming Society, which just held the first LGBT E3 after party for Sony. Chris, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
You know, I had to think about it for a bit. I think if I was thinking, and it's not necessarily my favorite entertainment, but if I was thinking of the thing that was most instrumental in entertainment that changed my life, I would actually say The Sims.
Oh, wow. Okay. So like the game where it's kind of like a little virtual dollhouse.
It's a virtual dollhouse, but I was thinking of just like, basically where you can create your own sim or sim family. You can experiment with seeing how they interact with each other and see kind of socially what they do, how they respond to things, how they respond to certain situations. So I was thinking of like which artistic medium probably has influenced my life the most. And I'd have to say The Sims for multiple reasons. It was probably like the first game that I know of that you had the option to choose LGBT characters. And it was a medium as someone who really doesn't understand really good social skills, especially as a child. It was kind of in a weird way a medium to kind of understand how people react and kind of the subtleties that my brain wasn't really picking up on. So I think it was really instrumental in that aspect as well.
Do you remember when you first found it?
I think, God, I remember being like a teenager. I think it was like 12 or 13 around that time. Like early teens, it might have been 14 actually, but sometime around then, like right before going into high school, right before like figuring out my sexuality, it was like the time that I discovered The Sims was probably also the first time that I also found like internet porn. Like it was around that age of my life.
Well, and what else does a kid need, really?
Yeah.
Do you remember like what kind of little worlds you built in the game?
I think I would do, as a kid, I didn't even know like LGBT romance was an option. I didn't even really know what gay was. Because I grew up in a very homophobic area. So I think I discovered that accidentally. And that was like one of my first experiences of like, oh my God, a man can kiss another man. Like there was kind of that experience with it. But I think initially my first type of thing was just honestly, I think creating a family of like things that I always wanted where there were clear identifiable rules and regulations to how this world worked. And I just remember, I think, creating, it wasn't like just creating like a fantasy life. I think for me, the fantasy was just that it was clear you could have an actual guidelines of like, if you do this, your Sims will do this. And if you do this, then your Sims will. So it was really cool to kind of create almost this like family that I always wanted in The Sims and kind of have interaction and stuff that I never really understood social interaction in that age. So I think that it was really helpful for me being on the spectrum, figuring out like, oh, and when this happens, it was very clear what the objectives were and how to make friends and stuff. And it was in a weird way, I think kind of helpful for my brain as well to be like, oh, when my sim goes out and does this, I could actually do that in real life. Like, it was kind of like that.
What were the rules that you created for your Sims?
Well, I would say it's not really necessarily that I would create rules. I just mean that I think a lot of times people on the spectrum in general, I was reading this cool article about how video games are so influential and become almost sometimes addictive for people who are on the spectrum, because we get really excited and we really love clear patterns and clear rules, where in real life, if someone says something, I don't know if they're being sarcastic, ironic, if there's like a hidden meaning behind what they're saying. In The Sims, it was always very clear. So I think what I was really excited is, here's this virtual reality simulation of the world, and I could not just do whatever I wanted, but I could clearly understand what the character's objectives were. I could clearly understand the boundaries. And in someone who has like almost an OCD type of way of looking at things, it was really awesome to finally experience, I guess, a world that the rules and regulations were very clearly made up, but was also still sandboxy, where you could explore and experiment with things.
Yeah, you said that something you were doing was creating a kind of a family that you wish you had. Mm-hmm. Was it purely that you understood the dynamics and the mechanics of the interaction, or were there particular things that you were like, I've got to have this?
I think it was less about wanting to have certain things, but it was more that the dynamics made sense, and that you could create whatever world that you wanted to live in. And I guess you're right, you can create the perfect house, you can create that type of thing. But also, it was a safe space of experimenting, where when you're in the closet and you can't do certain things or you can't feel certain ways, in this virtual world, it was almost like where I could kind of do any interaction I've ever dreamed of. I could, if I was mad at someone, I could lock them in a house and set it on fire. Like, it was kind of ridiculous like that, but it was kind of like a weird way to be like, oh, I can just do whatever I want here. And I've never really experienced that freedom, I think, in my life, because I was so in the closet and also just like emotionally shut down, afraid, because I, was dealing with sensory overload and all of that type of thing. And I also, there wasn't as a smaller gay kid growing up, it was difficult. And there wasn't really a chance to express anger. There wasn't really a chance to express a lot of feelings, because when you express feelings, it could put you in a situation where you could feel unsafe, unprotected, in harm's way. So it was cool, almost like virtual reality, of being like, oh, I can kind of express and do anything I want here. It's like an open sandbox, which is kind of why I relate to video games and work in video games. And I think a lot of LGBT people relate to video games.
Yeah. So tell me about like that growing up environment. You said it was, it sounds like you were pretty like, timid emotionally about like interacting with other people.
So I grew up in North Carolina, and, my family was really homophobic. I feel bad saying that, because I know my mom will listen and be like, no, but they've changed. They've really grown up. But I think when I was a kid, especially in the 90s, they were very, very homophobic, very, very religious. And I have some, family members that are very, the typical redneck, very racist, very backwards, very homophobic. And there wasn't really a safe space to really explore myself or, figure myself out. So I think for me, geek culture was that safe space, where a lot of the storylines are people who feel misrepresented in their home life and are looking for something better, and they get to be the hero. Which is why, in general, I mean, not just with The Sims, but with many things, I connected, with a lot of open world games, but also comic books, TV shows, etc. Though I wasn't allowed to watch a lot of TV, I would sneak up at night and watch certain things to try to feel like it was an escape of what I was going through, and feeling persecuted and feeling scared.
of being who I was.
What would you sneak in? Like, do you remember like particular shows that gave you the escape that you wanted?
Yeah, this is pretty risky. This is pretty risky. But when I was a kid, I would stay up at night and watch Three's Company. My family was like really no television. Like it was very, very religious household. So I would stay up until my parents were asleep and I would basically watch like Three's Company or the Brady Bunch or things that, you know, it seems so PC now. But for me, those were like the shows that I was, you know, sneaking up and watching. Eventually, as I got older, it'd be shows like The Real World or like South Park or stuff like that. Like that would be me around like, you know, 15 through 17, mm-hmm. sneaking up to watch those. But I think as a young kid, I was just waiting at night to try to get any form of relief from everything, which for me was watching old sitcoms. I loved laughing. And I think like John Ritter, especially for me, that was the first time that I saw what a gay person was. His character wasn't gay, but he was pretending. I don't know if you remember in like the early first seasons of Three's Company, was pretending to basically be a gay man so that he could live with two female roommates. Mm-hmm. And I think that was my first,
basically put one over on the landlord.
Yeah, that was, and it's so weird because it's so homophobic now, but as a product of its time, that was my introduction to what being gay was. And coming from my background, even though it's so backwards right now, but in my background, that was the most liberal thing ever to watch this man pretend, how dare he, you know, pretend to be like homosexual just so he could live with two women. It was like really groundbreaking for my mind. And I think that was like kind of, that was probably actually the first time that I knew a little bit of like, oh, what is this gay thing? And then I think when I actually started playing The Sims and saw that that was an option and you could kiss a man and you wouldn't be, you know, in persecution, it was a huge deal for me.
Yeah. So tell me about, you had the Sims to kind of create the queerness that you wanted to see in the world. Did you have other actual models for what gay was other than John Ritter pretending to be gay on Three's Company? Like, did you ever find other gay stuff out in the world?
Not until I was like 18 and moved out of my hometown, because it was very, actually, I would say the next time that I saw something that was pro LGBT was my friend showed me the movie V for Vendetta. And I remember there was a huge scene about, I think it was like a lesbian that was put in jail or something like that in that movie. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And I think that was then like probably my third opportunity, but yeah, growing up in a very, very closeted environment, it's almost sometimes hard to talk to other, especially like millennials that grew up in California and were always accepting. And they're like, what? You didn't have Will and Grace, or you didn't have this and that. And it's like, no, I wasn't really allowed to watch most forms of media. Strangely enough, my dad was really into video games, so the one media that I did have that was an escape was video games. So it was very kind of weird that my parents were very like, don't do this and you can't play this and whatever. But my dad was really huge into sci-fi and video games. So I guess the movies that like I was allowed to watch was like I was allowed to watch Star Wars and I was allowed to play video games. So I think that's why, oddly enough, that was kind of my introduction to being gay rather than having some sort of gay celebrity. I mean, I remember when Rosie O'Donnell came out and I would be allowed to watch like the Kids' Choice Awards. Like that was one of the things that my parents, and then they're like, no more Nickelodeon because Rosie O'Donnell is a lesbian and she's hosting the show. And I'm like, what's a lesbian? What? You know what I mean? Like I didn't understand what was going on. So there really wasn't an opportunity because I lived in a town that was so homophobic. And I think in a weird way, my parents were just trying to protect me from being gay. And they thought if they shielded me from certain experiences, which I know they feel a lot of a shame about now because they have really grown up and changed. And my mom's like very supportive now. But when I was a kid, she was afraid. And she just wanted me to be a normal boy and she wanted me to be happy. And it's hard. You have to empathize with people's actions, no matter how much they hurt you or, you know, make you feel scared or whatever growing up, especially your parents. But I think part of being a better person is also just trying to have empathy for where other people's actions were coming from. And I think in the sense of my family, I think in their eyes, they were trying to protect me at the time.
So you said that you moved out, left town. Where did you go?
I left town at 19 years old. I moved straight to California, which was not a very good idea for impressionable, you know, 19-year-old. But that was like right when I moved out of or finished high school. I moved out to California. I moved to Burbank first.
Okay. What brought you there? Like, were you going for school or did you know people out there?
It was kind of bizarre, but I had basically, I can't get too into detail, but I basically had like a opportunity in LA and just decided to go with it. And, really looking back at it, really not an intelligent idea behind me, but my family, actually, my mom and my dad supported me. They're like, he's always wanted to move away from a small town. He's never fit in here. Maybe this would be good for him. So they helped me find my first apartment and everything. And obviously, like, as soon as I moved to LA, it's like, oh, I'm going to vote for Obama and I'm going to do this. And like, I just quickly really started finding out who I was. It was probably like a year and a half after moving, maybe 2 years, that I came out as gay. I just needed this safe space to really understand what that meant and actually explore who I was.
So I know you said you can't talk too much about it, but was this like a career opportunity that presented itself in Burbank?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. So just a job opportunity. I was trying to figure out what I was. I met someone who lived in LA, basically pursued that for a bit. I started doing commercials for a while and then went to, you know, massage therapy school, and then eventually started doing stand up, which, was not really something I ever planned on doing. I actually started with, I did improv for a while. I was like, I was in a musical theater improv team. One of my friends, still really close friends, I was in the team. Her name is Kelly, and she's actually funny enough in the Star Wars movies now. We started together, and I think improv was kind of, in a weird way, it was like my way of being like learning again social skills and learning social cues, because you have to like yes and people. And for someone on the spectrum who's just like very much like, no, I do things my way. I do things this way. It was a huge, huge learning step and learning opportunity for me. So I started with that. We did musical improv for a while and we performed at like kids' birthday parties that were Harry Potter themed. And then I started doing stand up, and then I just fell in love with stand up because I never really knew how to communicate or tell my story or be honest or vulnerable like that. And that kind of became my form of media to kind of connect with people. So that's kind of a general story about how I moved to Los Angeles. And then, you know, since then, it's weird because it's like finally, the more that I've learned to accept my brain patterns, the more that I've learned how to accept who I am and accepting being a gamer. That was something that I felt ashamed of for a while, because you moved to LA and everyone, you know, is so cool. And you're like, I like video games. And working with the LA Gaming Society, you know, hosting PlayStation's first LGBT, like the more that I've done to just kind of really accept who I am, the better opportunities have come and the more success that I finally found.
When you started doing those improv classes, it sounds like it was really challenging you. How did you get over the, you mentioned the block of being very set in your ways and not wanting to yes and someone else's way of doing something. What was that adjustment like?
Oh, it was really, really difficult. I don't think if I didn't meet, honestly, it was like my second class that I tried doing, and I was booking a lot of commercials at the time. The only reason I did it was to do, you know, more commercials. And that's when commercials actually paid money. Like you could book like a few commercials and like pay a down payment for a house like in a year. Like it would be, yeah, commercials back then, because it was before like new media and everything, you could make a lot of money. So I was doing really successful at the time, but I think one of the things that's important for commercials is learning how to kind of guess and what's going on, because no one knows what they're doing. And they're, you know, anyone that's working on a commercial usually doesn't want to be working on a commercial. Mm-hmm. Like the director wants to be directing something else. Like it's kind of the thing, the job that everyone take, like that can be cool, but people take for the money. So I think a lot of what I've learned, especially because you have clients at last minute decide that they want to go in a different direction. What I learned is like, you have to have some sort of improv skills. And I don't do well with like new directions. Like I'm very much like set in my ways. So I started it. I hated it. It was awful. I'm going to be honest with you. I think meeting friends that were so loving, like meeting Kelly, for instance, who is so loving and accepting and so powerful and so positive and bright. She is one of the people that like meeting her, I think, changed my whole life. And it's why I'm so happy for her success, is because like, I wouldn't be here if I wasn't for her. Like she was one of those people that's like, you're interesting, you're different, I believe in you, you want to do stand-up after this, you do stand-up, I'm gonna go to all of your shows. And like I just met a few people, not just Kelly, but a few other people like my friend Carolina, who were just lovely like that. So I think for me, the reason why I was able to do it and keep on doing it was, for the first time, I also met people who were equally scared, equally vulnerable, and we shared kind of something together, feeling this vulnerability together. It also taught me that the only way to connect with people is bravery and vulnerability. And the only, you know, way to kind of to really truly live life and to get these friends that I wanted, because as someone, you know, who grew up on the spectrum and everything, it was so difficult to make friends. I didn't realize that part of it would just be being vulnerable, calling out your feelings. I feel nervous right now, just telling someone that. And that's what I learned, is I just took this class. I was scared out of my mind, and I started with classes. Eventually we found some success and we started getting paid for kids' birthday parties, but it was all, which was ridiculous, but it was all just by being vulnerable. And I think telling people, I feel scared, I feel nervous, I don't want to be here, and connecting and bonding with people in that way.
Yeah, it sounds like you were a really different person after 2 years of being there. You said you found out who you were and learned a lot about yourself and were ready to come out. Who's the Christopher who moved to LA, and how is he different from the Christopher like 2 years later?
Yeah, the person who like moved to LA, I honestly thought I was kind of shocked that I was going to go to Los Angeles, because I think when I was growing up, I always thought that I was going to be a minister or something like that, which I think a lot of closeted people do, because they're like, well, I don't want to get married, I don't want to do this, so I guess being a minister is going to be my thing. But then I met someone, I think a lot of it's luck, but a lot of it was just meeting people who just saw the pain, you know what I mean, that I was going through. And I was just like, here, I'm going to do one thing to help you and push you in the right direction. And it was lots of little pushes like that. Yeah, but before I moved to LA, I mean, I was very much in the closet, very much like, I'm going to be a, you know, messenger of God, like that type of thing. And then literally within a year and a half, I was like, nope.
You said people could see the pain that you were feeling and help you with that. Was it the pain of just being closeted?
Yeah, a lot of people knew I was a closeted gay kid. I've always been very feminine, and I've been very bad at hiding it. And I shouldn't say bad at hiding it, but in the sense that when I was a kid, I think there's also just a part of me ingrained in me that's like, I cannot be anything but myself, meaning as far as my spectrum of gender. So I think that it's weird, because I was in the closet, but at the same time, I was just never a masculine kid, and I wasn't able to pretend to be masculine. And I think that I was very lucky enough where I've met in my life older gay men that recognize themselves, their story, and me, and helped me out. And people that I haven't even thought of, honestly, until this interview for years, that were just kind to me. And I don't think I would be able to get here unless some of those people, you know, really saw me and took a chance in me. So, and not even that, even just like my first, the first guy that I dated was a lot older than me. And was just really kind about like, here, you're in a situation. This is your first guy that you've been with. We're going to figure out who you are. And was just patient and kind. I've just been really lucky, I think, when I was in my early 20s to find men like that, that were just like, and some of them were just very nice, weren't trying to flirt, were just very kind. I think that even back then, there are just a lot of gay people that understand the importance of creating a family and the importance of, I see this young kid, he's going through a lot. I know what it's like to be through a painful experience where you're closeted or you're going through this, and the other. And I think that they knew that they had to be somewhat of a family for me because they've probably have been through life situations where they've had to find their own family.
In that process of like building up your, like the logical queer family that you wanted around you, often like a part of that is introducing folks to entertainment and being like, oh, you have to read this book or you have to see this movie. Did you experience any of that?
So I would say what happened to me is, I was playing video games a lot as a kid, but when I moved to Los Angeles, I stopped playing for a bit, mainly was watching, I'm trying to think what the guys that I was, you know, talking to at the time, it was more like plays and stuff like that, which is never my thing. Like I'm not a theater fan. I just like having to sit down and watch, it was not my thing. It was around like 23 or 24 that, one of my friends was like, there's this LA gamer group in Los Angeles and you should check it out. And, I liked video games, but I kind of had to put a pause in my life because I was figuring myself out there. And that's when, for instance, I remember the very first party I met my friend Cannon Spackman, who heads our organization. He's like the president of LA Gaming Society right now. And he kind of got me back into playing PlayStation and stuff and open world games and realizing like, oh, sometimes escaping from life is a really good thing. And actually, if anything, this just like having more topics in in nerd culture can actually help me bond with people. So I think like Cannon was probably one of my first friends, that I met from Lags that just, Lags is, sorry, the short name for LA Gaming Society. But he's one of the first people I met from Lags that kind of got me into, I'm trying to think the first game that he got me into. I think it was probably Skyrim. Skyrim was probably my return back into gaming because it just came out of it was right before it came out, like on Xbox. So I got into Skyrim and, that was something that I shared because, again, Skyrim's very much sandboxy. You can choose your own venture. You can choose to be whatever orientation you want, I believe. Like, there's many options. I think there's some games in Obsidian, Mass Effect that had options as well. So I started to get into it again with meeting people through LA Gaming Society and started to realize that this thing that I used to kind of study social interaction is also a means that I can use to also connect with people. And I think there's a common misconception with video games that video games is something that people do to disconnect from other people. But if anything, I've learned that it's the exact opposite. I meet so many friends and people by talking about what I'm playing or talking about the experiences that I have. My nerd culture is like, I love TV shows. I love old 90s shows. Like right now I'm watching, I was never allowed to watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer, for instance, as a kid. So I'm watching that for the first time right now, which is amazing and queer and awesome. And, it's just cool because I've learned that, like, I think I thought growing up that these things, like, that parents are like, oh, video games, or just stay inside and not talk to anyone. But actually, if used properly, they're a great tool for connection. I can play Destiny with my dad, who lives all the way in North Carolina and has been having health issues this year. We can connect and still do something together because he can log into his PlayStation and I can log into mine and we can share that experience together. So I think there was also a huge fundamental shift, you're right, in just figuring out, oh, these things that I loved as a kid, I can't shut down that part of me. I can actually use it as a way to connect with other people.
Do you have particularly memorable experiences? You mentioned making friends with like Cannon and other folks in that group. Memorable like parties or maybe in-game experiences that like stick with you many years later?
I mean, I think the biggest one is obviously last year, PlayStation letting us host their first LGBT E3 after party. That was just huge because we had 2,200 people Wow. that showed up. And yeah, we knew that it was going to be a good event. We knew like a few hundred Mm-hmm. people would show up. We didn't realize it was going to be that big. And we were all super emotional afterwards because, well, I should also leave. I started the group for a while just as a member, but eventually over the last few years started moderating and event planning and that type of thing. So this one was like Cannon wanted to help out and he's like, I really want to help out. I really want to have a huge party and I really want PlayStation involved because Cannon works for PlayStation. And after talking and talking and working and working, we eventually got it approved. And it was a huge deal. We had that many people, which we had all these, you know, executives and people that came that were just shocked because they're like, this is a huge group of people. This is a group of people that we've overlooked. And that was amazing to see because I think they finally saw the line all around the block. I mean, it was the craziest, like, E3 party ever. Like, for a line to be all the way, like, circling around the block, it was crazy. And it was a powerful moment because we were like, we are a huge group. And I think we felt like this huge thing of like, this is a community. This is something we're all building together. And there's still much more work to do. But it's also, there are so many like women there and even straight men there that just wanted a safe space. And they probably haven't had that in a while because there's still a lot of issues in the, you know, video game industry that we try to create a safe space for. So if people don't feel safe, you know, working at whatever game company they have, they can come to one of our parties and feel like, oh, this is really inclusive and inviting. So I think that was the biggest moment for me as far as feeling like, wow, this is something that's powerful. And I mean, since then, every precinct we've had has been like at least 800 people that have shown up. And most of those have had not even a sponsor. We just post an event and 800 people will show up.
Well, and that's particularly huge since, like you said, getting game executives to see, game industry executives to see, this is a group of people we've overlooked, hopefully will change how they do business in the future.
We still have a really, really long way to go, especially because a lot of these companies are... So I went with Cannon to Tokyo a few months ago. He had some meetings with PlayStation. He took me around and introduced me to some people, and it was really amazing. But one of the things that I learned going to Japan is also how culturally in that side we have a lot of work to do. And you have a lot of executives, you know, from the Japanese side that are still trying to understand this type of westernized pro-LGBT movement that we have. But I do have to say PlayStation has been the most embracive company and just so excited to bring inclusivity and bring more and more people. It's not about leaving, you know, I think some people are like, oh, it's not about leaving anyone out. It's just about including more and more people into video games, which is important. So we still have a lot of work to do, especially, I mean, you know, we've seen the news that's going on with Riot Games and everything and how they, you know, women have felt treated working there. And I can't even imagine some of the, you know, LGBT employees I've talked to that work there. It's a tough environment. We still have a lot of work to do in those spaces to make them safe for other people. But I think we're putting up a really good fight. And the first thing that we can do is just have a really nice, enjoyable, safe space where fans of video games, but also people who work in the industry can go to.
Hmm. Yeah. Can you tell me about like your experience in Japan? That must have been amazing going there. And what did you hear that made you realize we have more progress that we need to make?
I'm trying to think what I can say. I think I can't get too specific, but I will say that I think in general, the culture in Japan deals with things, especially they're having their own backwards political movement that's also very sexist in general, but they deal with things, especially a lot of more conservative people from Japan deal with things in a way where if they see something that's gay, they're like, oh, that's, we don't have that here. Like, this doesn't really exist. Like, the homophobia in Japan is very different, where in America, we're very outwardly vocal against gay people. I mean, not we, but I mean, people who are homophobic are outwardly, you know, vocal against them or harassment and that type of thing. In Japan, they more so just like to pretend that it doesn't exist. And if there is LGBT representation, I mean, a perfect example is the latest Fire Emblem video game. There's multiple romance options, especially actually for woman-on-woman romance options. Most of those are over-sexualized. And then there's really only, what is it, like two man-on-man romances that they've added, which for them is a huge deal.
Oh, there's only one.
I'm
very frustrated Lindhart. About this myself. It's Lindhart, and I'm like, him?
Someone who has nothing, apparently not much to do with the storyline, and it's very stereotypical, and I think it's crazy, but on the Japanese side, that's huge and very progressive, and people are probably shocked that Nintendo is doing something like this. They also were removing stages in Smash Brothers that had the transgender flag on them, or created a transgender flag, because they found it to be too political. So, whereas, you know, PlayStation's very progressive, I think Nintendo still has a long ways to go, but it's also interesting because that's where LGBT people really find themselves loving, is they keep asking us, they're like, can we please have a Nintendo sponsored event? And we're like, yeah, when Nintendo sponsors it. They've sponsored one for, I think it's called Gamers Inc., the London gamer group, but that's because, you know, the European side of Nintendo are a little bit, you know, have a little bit more liberations than the American side. Yeah, we have a long way to go in video games. And I think that especially Japanese culture, there's they're dealing with a lot of changes, and it's good to see things like Assassin's Creed. There's LGBT, any role-playing game basically that's developed in the United States has pretty much at least LGBT sub-characters and side quests or romance options. But I think the Japanese side, we still have, you know, a way to go with them just because of the big culture difference.
Well, it sounds like you're in a unique position to have a role in that with your like extensive background, like personally learning from games, like what the, you know, what the world can be, and learning about yourself through games and seeing what a tool they can be. But then also with the improv work that you've done and really being conscientious about listening and supporting other people and developing empathy for other people's needs. Like, that sounds like that's exactly what's needed to help game companies understand, like, not that you need to have like siloed queer content here and straight content here, but like when everyone's invited in, everyone feels comfortable and you have more romance options than just sleepy, boring Lindhart, then everybody wins.
Yeah, I saw Lindhart and I was like, he sleeps all the time and doesn't want to be involved in anything. I was like, I don't want to date my ex again. I'm good. I was like, we don't need this. I think, yeah, it's a cool position. I think that's kind of my role in LAGS is, you know, I am a comedian, and I think having some sort, since I have a decent social media following and I have the social statistics to back me, I'm able to kind of bring people on board that it's stupid, but they're kind of impressed by those type of things. And then we have Canon, who, for instance, is very much involved with more of the corporate life of PlayStation. We have people like one of our longest admin, Jamil, is more involved with like social media and the printing side of things and making sure event planning goes well. So everyone fills a different role. I think what's actually really cool, and the reason why Canon and I specifically bonded, is his family was very, you know, homophobic as well. And there are a lot of people that came from homophobic backgrounds. The cool thing is that everyone on our team, no matter what their background, they have a specific amount of empathy. And I think that it allows for amount of change because you have to understand where people are going from. You have to understand, like when I went to Japan, I had to like really humble myself and be like, this is the culture here. And I know what it's like having empathy for my family members who some of them I still don't talk to this day because of who I am. I mean, for years. So it's like, it's a cool position you're right to be in because I've had to learn to overcome these things being on the spectrum. And I think I also relate to sometimes some of the people who write hate comments online because I know what it's like to feel lonely and just want your voice to be heard. And even though I don't believe that they're doing it in the right way, I at least try to empathize and understand where they're coming from, because the only way that we can really have change is to not just scream angrily at other people, but to come from a place of love and to also show who we are in the most vulnerable sense, and show that we are good people and show that no matter what hate that they have, that it won't really affect us, but also, you know, be strong in our character and our integrity. So I've tried to, from someone who's on the spectrum and gay, develop myself socially, but also just try to develop that empathy so that when I am in situations or anything that I can do where I can change any sort of industry, I can empathize with people, but also be strong in my morals and integrity and what I believe we should be doing.
What was it like when you came out? Because it sounds like your parents helped you move out there, this fresh-faced kid who was ready to become a minister at some point. What was your coming out to family experience like?
It was awful. I think it's really weird because it was right at the same time where people are like, it gets better. And I was like, does it? Because it was not. And I think that's why they don't use that campaign anymore, because you can't promise that it will get better. And then you had a bunch of kids that were living in the middle of nowhere that were upset because for them, it didn't get better. For some people, it doesn't. And it's a struggle. And it's hard to tell people, everyone in general, it does get better. Because it's not really something that you can promise. For me, coming out was very difficult. I didn't talk to my mom for a very, very, very long time. And it took a lot of healing. It's why I also, a few years after doing comedy, I started stand-up. And it was until I started doing stand-up, talking about, for instance, my mother being very homophobic at the time, that was what healed the relationship, because talking about something and laughing about something that's painful, it makes other people relate to it, but you also find healing through laughter. I really believe that laughing is sometimes one of the most healing things you can do when dealing with hardship and heartache. So when I started stand up, it was a way of therapeutically dealing with the fact that I wasn't close to my family anymore, and I wanted to rebuild a relationship with them, and I needed them to accept that I'm the new me, and I needed to accept also just where they were at and where my parents are coming from on certain things. So in a weird way, comedy was what healed the relationship between me and my family, because it helped me to empathize their point of view and why they couldn't accept certain things.
Was that helpful for them? Like, what helped them come around?
I think listening to my comedy about... So a lot of what I would do with stand-up in my early stand-up is I would find things that my mother would say and try to find the logic behind it. And the logic behind something so ridiculous and homophobic is what made... like, there was one day that she did come to me and she was like, Chris, I'm proud of you. I'm proud of anyone that has to live their life with a disability, which was like so painful and so hurtful. But then I had to spin that into a joke. Mm-hmm. And that became the premise of like a whole bit that I have that I don't want to repeat, but you can find online. But you can find that on the Amazon show that I'm in. But what I did is I found the things that she said that would be hurtful to me, and I'd learn how to spin it into humor and find almost a way to empathize with why she was feeling the way that she felt. And I think for them, it was healing because it called out some of their issues, but in a way where people were laughing at it relating to feeling imperfect, and it didn't make them, it wasn't just shouting like, you're wrong, you're a horrible person. Instead, it was like, listen, you're wrong about this. We're all wrong about certain things. This is why you're wrong. It says it, it just says it in a loving way, in a way where people are laughing. And I think when people are laughing, it's like their armor's taken off. Like, they're able to actually be affected by things, and their ego is really taken down. So I think by laughing about it and putting light in the darkness, it made it where she was able to put, like, my mom was able to put her ego aside and actually listen to it. A majority of my family, most of my uncles, my grandfather, for instance, I don't talk to anymore, and I haven't talked to in multiple years. And I probably will never have a relationship with them, but I'm very glad that at least with my mom and my dad, I'm able to talk to them again.
Yeah, and it's something I think that is new for you. You've been working on this sort of radical empathy for a long time, just as part of your career. From reading your recent posts on Facebook, something that's newer for you is talking openly about being on the spectrum. And so how's that something that became a part of, like, what you talk about openly?
Gosh, that was, it's been a journey this year. I almost lost my dad, and one of my good friends, and I went to a place where I don't know how to explain this, coming out of being on the spectrum was just as important for me as coming out as gay, because I always knew that my mind was working, like, a little bit differently than other people. We had hints and teachers, you know, that told my parents, and I knew for a while, but I was so like, no, this isn't who I am. This isn't who I am. And then eventually, when I almost lost my dad, I don't know why, but my brain was like, I can't live life like this anymore. My brain functions differently. I'm so tired of accidentally offending people or saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, or just excitingly only talking about my own interests all the time, or these weird rituals that I have that was pushing my significant other away from me, or times where I was shutting down or viewing things in a different light than other people. I was like, I know that my brain works differently and I need to accept it. So weirdly enough, I just started talking. At the time, I didn't really understand the difference between Asperger's and being on the spectrum. So I just started talking about, I feel like I have Asperger's. And I just started talking about it on stage, which is also probably not the best way to talk about it. Like, I should have just waited or whatever. But the diagnosis process took months and was exhausting. It's so hard to get a diagnosis with being on the spectrum as an adult. So it's been a journey this year, but yeah, I started talking about it on stage. That's how most of my friends found out about it. And most of them knew, because I've, you know, had weird conversations, you know, they know me, like, they know how they're like, Chris, with his obsession with knowing these certain facts about this anime or this show and knowing about this and going on about it for forever and then not picking up on this cue and then awkwardly just leaving in the middle of a conversation, like, they knew. So it wasn't a big deal for most people. For a few people, it was. And it was one of the reasons where I felt it was one of the reasons my past relationship for 4 years ended, because my ex was like, I just don't think he signed on to experience that. And it changed who I am. It changed accepting myself. It kind of made me realize by accepting that I'm on the spectrum, it's also accepting that I need to figure out daily practices, daily techniques to be a better person. And I always knew that. I've always been doing that with Yes and improv or whatever. And, you know, that stuff carried on with me through just social conversations. But by accepting who I am, I also, it was more like also accepting, like, I need to be honest about this, be as vulnerable as possible about this process, and slowly just be a better person, be a person with better boundaries, be a person that, instead of just going, because a lot of times people on the spectrum, we don't understand social cues. So when someone does something, we just go along with it. Like, I'm reading a book called, was a list of daily practices. And he was explaining, he's like, if I was at a supermarket and someone gave me a banana costume and just told me to wear it for 5 minutes, I would, and I wouldn't question it because my brain doesn't really process that this is weird. So a lot of, like, what the work that I've been doing this year is kind of also just changing, like, I can't keep being this person. Like I did yet. I learned how to go along with people, but now I also need to learn the social cues of when not to go along people, when to stand my ground, when to own my truth, when to own my honesty. And also just make fun of myself in situations when I sometimes might accidentally make someone feel uncomfortable instead of just sitting in it, calling out what just happened. What did I just do? Like figuring it out kind of in the moment. So yeah, I started talking about it in stand-up first, and then I started going through the diagnosis process. And then in, I think it was June, I officially finally got it in paper that I was on the autism spectrum, which was just like the coolest relief ever because it's something that I kind of deep down knew, but was finally accepting that my brain just operates differently.
So what does that change for you now? Like just in your day-to-day going around in the world, what does it mean to like to have the diagnosis, to know what you kind of always knew and the people around you were aware of, but to be able to put a name to it and a whole system of diagnosis and I guess intervention or treatment. What makes life different now knowing that?
I feel like for the longest time, if my brain's been a car, I've been pushing this car. And it's like by realizing that I'm on the autism spectrum, my agent actually gave me this analogy and it's really great. It's as if someone finally was like, wait, here's the keys. Now drive it. And you're like, wait, what? I thought that I had to push it this whole time. I didn't realize I could just sit in the car and drive it. So what I've been able to do is it kind of gave me a roadmap of like, whoa. You live in this world where people function this way and you've been trying to function this way while knowing and, you know, talking about in therapy that you don't necessarily function this way. But what we're going to do is we're going to give you a list of how your brain naturally does function and give you some tips and cues to kind of learn how to process the world in a way that's, you know, that's more suitable for your brain and in a way that works along better with other people. So for me, by accepting my diagnosis, I've also been able to take in all this knowledge and wisdom for other people that have similar brain patterns and be able to kind of use that now to just make myself a better person and learn how to communicate more clearly and be more honest.
Is there stuff that you're looking forward to tackling now, like things that you've wanted to try or do or just didn't feel ready for, but now you're like, okay, here I go?
I think what I'm most excited about is that I know this sounds really silly, but I think I've always, especially in like relationships and things, I've really had to carry on a mask or try to be something for the other person. And I think the weird thing about this whole thing is while I found out I was on the spectrum, I had to leave my, you know, last relationship because I was like, this isn't functioning anymore and it's not helping me really figure out who I am. And I need to learn how to be on my by myself and be strong on my own two feet. So I think what I'm most excited about is really accepting, A, that my brain needs a certain amount of recharge and it's okay to take introvert time. It's okay to say no. It's also okay to accept that in parties and social surroundings, I'm going to have sensory overload. And that's something that I just thought I was sensitive or weird. And I never really knew that that was also like just, oh, being, you know, a lot of people have sensory overload. And by accepting that that's how my brain functions and operates, it also allows me to kind of ask for help when I need it. Because I know that my brain operates differently. So I think, in a weird way, I'm excited to have clear boundaries. I'm excited to just be myself. And I'm excited to ask for help when I need it because I know that my brain functions differently. And if I need help, there are plenty of people who, if I'm at a party and if I'm feeling overwhelmed and need to walk away for a bit, there are plenty of people that I can pull aside that will help me and help me when I'm in need and I'm not at my strongest. And yeah. So I think it's boundaries and asking for help, a weird combination of those two things.
Well, that sounds great. I think that's something that, you know, is beneficial for anyone to be able to come to terms with needing, but especially in the position that you're in to have so much empathy with, you know, as in a leadership position with the gaming society, to recognize your needs there and to be able to understand that other people are going to have that and to be able to provide a space where they can feel comfortable asking for that. That's really awesome.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, if people want to check out your work or the Gaming Society or anything else that you're working on, where are some places to go online?
So what you can do is on Instagram, LA Gaming Society, we're at LA Gamers, GAYMERS. You can also catch me on Instagram at Tinder Chris. That's TENDER Chris, CHRIS. I have a stand-up special called Out on Stage, which is a series of LGBT comics, and that's out on Amazon Prime right now. You can check that on Amazon Prime and see some of my jokes on there where I'm actually funny. And then there is also, you can check on Cooking on High on Netflix, where you can check me judging out edible marijuana.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, Chris, thanks for joining me. Thanks again to Chris for joining me. You might have noticed how excited I got when he brought up the topic of the game Fire Emblem. I've been completely obsessed with it since it came out earlier this month, and it's my recommendation this week. You might think of it as being sort of like chess, but with a dating simulator on top. The game takes place at a military academy, and you play as a professor managing a house full of students. Some days you handle interpersonal issues, take students to lunch, help them develop relationship with each other. Other days you head out onto the battlefield, moving units on a grid to capture and defeat each other. It's a fantastic blend of very crunchy mechanics and surprising interpersonal interaction. But if there's a major shortcoming to the game, it's that its romance options, as we discussed, are almost entirely heterosexual. That's a big disappointment, and hopefully something that can be changed in future updates to the game. But in the meantime, remember, just because a romance isn't in the game doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Canonicity, that is the fact of a story established by its owner as canon, is merely a capitalist illusion. As the audience, the stories you tell about the characters are as legitimate as those told by the company that sold them to you. So don't be put off entirely by the lack of options in this or any game. Whatever you come up with is going to be better anyway. Thanks again for listening, and a reminder that right now we're running a Kickstarter for Dungeons & Dragons & Drag Queens on the Road. Head over to Kickstarter.com and search for Queens of Adventure's Legendary Journey for details and some fabulous backer rewards. Let me know what you think of the show on Twitter and Facebook or sewerspodcast@gmail.com. Big thanks to everyone who's reviewed the show on your podcast platform of choice. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incomtech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.